This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, Georgia Hargreaves here with you for the Country Hour this afternoon. Thanks for tuning in on the ABC Listen app and online. Now, coming up shortly, the freight industry is backing calls from the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission for urgent government policy reform to address skyrocketing port charges. And after an update from the Bureau of Meteorology at midday, you'll hear about some of the research that's being done on zero alcohol wine, how much of a market there is for it, and how to make it taste as good as the real stuff. That's coming up just before news at one. Some sad news to start off with, though, this afternoon. A 34-year-old man fighting a bushfire near Ongerup in the state's Great Southern region has died after a branch from a fire-damaged tree fell on his car. The man was part of a local farmer response unit, and he had earlier been helping local firefighters respond to an emergency-level bushfire in the area, about 400 kilometres southeast of Perth. Police say he was travelling along Old Ongerup Road when the branch fell onto his car, crushing the cab. We understand that was about 8:15 last night. Sadly, he suffered critical injuries and died at the scene. Police are not treating this death as suspicious, and they will prepare a report for the coroner. Our thoughts are with the man's friends and family. And you'll get an update shortly on that bushfire, which has now been downgraded to an advice level. Meanwhile, a bushfire burning south of Eneabba in the state's midwest has claimed at least 300 sheep, some crops and pasture, along with two vacant houses and some other infrastructure. Kuru Shire President Guy Sims says the community is still coming to terms with the full extent of the damage, and the firefighting effort was made that much harder when the mobile network went down.
I think there's a sense of relief that the worst is now over. It's been a very challenging time, and all our farmers and firefighters, etc., out in the Warradarge area have had a very tough time the last since 6 o'clock Sunday morning.
And the fires burnt through at least 13,000 hectares. What sort of losses are to structures or pastures and machinery are we talking about, as far as you know?
So at the moment, as far as I know, there are two houses that have been lost. But as I understand it, those houses were not occupied, so they were vacant houses. A couple of sheds have been lost, and I believe one accommodation unit, so a donga. Yeah, significant loss of pasture and crops, and unfortunately we have confirmed that 300 sheep were lost. And an unconfirmed report, so I stress unconfirmed, that there's possibly another 200 sheep that have been lost. There is a feedlot that's located just to the east of Warradarge on the Crewe Greenhead Road. There were cattle being adjusted there. As I understand it, those cattle have survived, but you can imagine that those cattle would be severely traumatised, locked in a paddock with fire surrounding them. And I've spoken to the owner of some of the cattle that are registered there, and they're hoping to get there today to relocate them. Haven't been able to do so up until now because of just access to that area.
Right, and as far as crops go, what sort of crops are in the area, and do we know what extent has been lost?
I don't have a figure of total hectares of crop that's been lost, but it would have been mainly wheat and lupins that have been lost.
What was the response from the community to this fire?
A massive response from our farmer response group, that not just from the Waradaj area, but coming in from surrounding areas. There were at least 60 farmer response appliances of various and different types there. Yeah, absolutely huge response from farmers. And the role that they play is often underestimated and underappreciated. Yeah, certainly all our volunteer brigades were there, and are very thankful the support from DFES and DPOR, etc. But tremendous effort from the farmer response.
With interruptions to mobile connectivity and power throughout the regions lately, did this have any effect on the response of firefighters and farmers, as far as you know?
Yes, it did have an effect, and a very, very severe effect. Yeah, we've been through, prior to the fire season, you know, all the training. We've had meetings with communities, so there's some level of preparedness. So for firefighters, they use WhatsApp, because it's a very efficient way of communicating. But, of course, when you lose with an extended power outage that we've had, you lose all communications. So, yeah, communications on the fire ground, very difficult. But I'd also say cause severe issues in surrounding towns, Lehman Greenhead at the moment. Without any sort of phone coverage, it would be hard to contact emergency services. And we had exactly the same situation inland for 2 days. I think we need a rethink on what we do with telecommunications when these things happen. I think there needs to be recognised there needs to be an investment in backup power for mobile towers, and that backup power can't be batteries that only last for 6, 10, 12 hours.
Kuru Shire President Guy Sims, he was speaking with Brianna Melville about a fire that's burning around 250 kilometres north of Perth. It's 12 past 12. You're listening to The Country Hour this afternoon. And a Waradaji farmer, Sarah Dring, and her family have lost water points, feed and pasture in that fire. They've also lost land that they had fenced off for conservation.
Our family has land conservation at our heart. Nearly 40 years ago, my parents fenced off hundreds of acres of remnant bushland, providing habitat for wildlife and protecting the unique flora our area is known for. For the bush to recover, we need to replace more than 20 kilometres of fencing, and that's just an estimate. We are hoping Blaze Aid will be able to help us achieve this. It's just absolutely devastating for our Waradaji area, and it's going to take a very long time to be able to replace things like our fences. And going into summer with very limited feed, we haven't had time to talk to all the other farmers, but we personally lost 250 hay bales and pretty much all of our ungrazed pastures. And we're predominantly sheep farmers, so going into summer, we have to look at selling sheep or trying to find a adjustment that we can manage as a small family business.
And how did your stock go? Are all your sheep okay?
Yes, there are a few mobs that we only just saved, and I mean just got out of the paddock in time. We have lost sheep that got left behind, and we have stock as well that have been burnt that we are managing, and there are some sheep that we need to go and put down. There are farmers in the area who lost hundreds of sheep though.
How much time did you have to get those sheep out that you did manage to get out?
The particular mob that I saved, I had minutes. They were in the corner of the paddock. The whole paddock was burnt. I got off the fire truck and jumped in a ute, went up there, and yeah, they were 5 minutes from not having anywhere to go. And my mum moved most sheep with our beautiful friend who used to work for us, Tracy. and they worked together to save all the fire, all the sheep from the second day of fires, which was Monday. We can't thank the volunteers, DFIS, and firefighters enough. Fighting the fire in the terrible weather conditions without phone service made things extremely challenging. We just simply didn't have enough people and resources to manage the severity of the fire. We want to extend a massive thank you to all the air support who not only saved all of our homes and structures, but they also made sure we were safe whilst we were fighting the fire. We're very grateful for no life losses.
Wurundjeri farmer Sarah Dring, she was speaking with Brianna Melville. It's 12:15 on the Country Hour this afternoon, and on yesterday's program, you heard Noah Cold talking about a fire just south of there that took out some of his crops near Magumba. He also mentioned it burned the Magumba Mission, which dates back to 1917. It was a government-run institution where Aboriginal children were taken after being forcibly removed from their families. You can read more about it online if you're interested. Just do a search for ABC Midwest and you'll find that story from Piper Duffy. 12:16.
This is the WA Country Hour with Georgia Hargreaves on ABC Radio WA.
Now, further south, firefighters are still mopping up a bushfire that reached an emergency level near Ongerup yesterday. This area is roughly 400 kilometres southeast of Perth. The blaze started around midday and has since been downgraded to an advice level. Jai Duggan farms just south of Ongerup and says they were lucky the fire didn't cause more damage.
It was actually in the office at home, and yesterday it was probably 130 units, but we all got assigned to different areas. But my main task was just looking after a speed tiller, which is a plough. Yeah, just trying to make breaks out in the stubble ahead of the fire.
What was it looking like?
Yeah, it was obviously pretty big. I think it was over 5,000 hectares burnt, but fairly strong northwesterly. And then we probably had a bit of a wind change at 3-4 o'clock. And then it come closer to 5. It was pretty severe. I think we had a forecast of over 100k winds at one point. Yeah, and then the fire basically come around and then come up beside itself again. So we kind of end up chasing it around in a big circle in the end. But, we had no chance of stopping at the front. Luckily, we had plenty of bombers that got called in.
Any idea of how it started?
Yeah, I did heard reports on over the fire radio that someone saw a pole that looked like it had been our pole. It had been struck by lightning, but I'm not sure if that's been confirmed. But seems to be near the point of where it started. So, yeah.
Obviously, we are right in the thick of harvest at the moment, and, you know, bushfires are absolutely the last thing that you want to be happening right now at any time, obviously. Have you heard from any growers about loss of crop or anything like that?
Yeah, it was mostly, I'm only guessing, but there's probably half of it was still standing crop, so there's probably only one farmer I've talked to about, and he thinks he's probably lost 650 hectares of standing crop, and there's a hell of a lot of it was all across stubbles, and it was obviously creek lines, a bit of bush in between, but there's a lot of stubbles and standing crop that went. So
are you heading out again today, Jai?
Yep, I'm just out in the fire ground now. We're just doing a bit of a mop up. Still got some fairly strong winds forecast. So we're just putting in some more plough breaks and basically trying to make everything secure.
What's your message to growers and property owners in the area as we head into today, obviously a day after an emergency bushfire whipped through the area? What do people need to know?
Always be prepared, and if you have a fire, just bloody be safe. Don't put yourself in any danger. So we've got plenty of aerial support and everything these days. So main thing is everyone gets home. So lucky to have a lot of volunteers that generally come out here, so you have a lot of help on the ground. Don't go anywhere you shouldn't do. Make sure you can get out.
Mixed grain farmer and volunteer firefighter Jai Duggan. He was speaking with Amelia Searson about yesterday's bushfire near Ongerup, which is in the Great Southern region. It's 19 past 12. You're listening to the Country Hour this afternoon. Now, scientists from the University of Adelaide have had a breakthrough in research on Wagyu genetics in a study that's hoped to improve breeding and beef marbling of the Japanese cattle. Dr. Lloyd Lowe is a senior bioinformatician with the University of Adelaide, and he says now researchers and producers have a clearer picture of Wagyu genetics, they can make more informed decisions.
The first cattle genome was released around 2009, and since then it has not been completed. Not even any of the chromosome is complete. So in this work, we have completed some of the chromosomes, and you can think of it as the most complete genetic map of cattle to date.
So what's the benefit of learning this, having a much better blueprint than before? What benefits might it have for the industry?
There is practical benefits in terms of selecting the animals genetically, because before we didn't have a complete map. So we were mainly using one class of genetic variant known as single nucleotide polymorphisms. There is actually a lot more genetic variation in cattle that have been less studied. So with a more complete map, we can tap into a new class of genetic variants known as structural variants. So this will lead to better markers for selecting them for practical application. But it's also for biology, like understanding the biology of the species as well.
And in your research, how different has Wagyu been to other types of cattle?
So we already know even beforehand that Wagyu is highly inbred. So if you look at its genetics, you can clearly see it's distinct from other breeds. So to tell you more, this is actually something that I'm still actively working on, like what's the difference in Wagyu and genetically and the potential biological impact of that. That is actually still my active research.
Senior bioinformatician with the University of Adelaide, Dr. Lloyd Lowe. He was speaking to Elsie Adamo about the breakthrough in research on Wagyu genetics, which is hoped to improve breeding and beef marbling of the Japanese cattle. So with genetic mapping improving, Wagyu's future in Western Australia looks pretty bright. But producers say the next step is figuring out how to scale up. Hossam Shabake is the sales and marketing director at Pardew Wagyu, which owns Pardew Station up here in the Pilbara. And he says WA needs stronger feedlot and processing capacity before Wagyu production can grow.
The biggest challenge we have here in WA is the feedlot and the processing capacity. When you look at the, again, you know, we are processing actually at the three big abattoirs in the state, and we have more cattle to process that we can get space for. Also, the feedlot capacity is crucial, and we have another operation on the East Coast to offset that. So we have cattle on feed in Queensland. We are also using two abattoirs in Queensland to, you know, to just have access to certain markets from the eastern states abattoirs, and also to mitigate our risk with the limited capacity of abattoirs and feedlot here in WA. So to answer your question, there is room to grow, but also there are challenges that we need to work through and sort out.
I'm aware Pardew Wagyu have plans to build a 10,000 head feeding facility. Where are you at with that now?
We actually have capacity of around 3,000 to 4,000 animals feeding facility at Pardew Station. And we're going through the process of getting all the approvals and the finances for the feeding facility to expand on what we've got. But that's not happening in the next year or two. So probably we're expecting that to be announced next year when this project will be underway.
And where does Pardew process its cattle at the moment?
So we process our cattle in WA at Harvey Beef in Harvey, Dansaz, and we are also processing some of our cattle at V&V Walsh in Bunbury and Western Meat Packers in Quarumup.
Do you expect that will change in the near future, given the sale of Kimberley Meat Company to TLP for Australian Holdings is now complete? Because I understand that abattoir is only about 600 kilometres from Padu.
That's right, that's right. But the nature of that abattoir, or at least the nature we know about it, is more like it was designed for the northern cattle, for the pastoral cattle, not really for premium beef production. So I'm not quite sure how it will be after they reopen it. It's tricky, though. It will be suitable for us for certain type of cattle, but for our premium beef, since we have the cattle located here in Perth, specifically on the wheat belt for feeding, it just doesn't make sense to truck them back to the north for processing, if you know what I mean. Because by the time they finish the feeding time at the feedlot, we're looking at 700 and 750 kilo live weight. So the most sensible thing is to send them to the closest abattoir for animal welfare, and also for the quality of the abattoir itself. You know, the Harvey, VMV, Walsh, Western Meat Packers are known for processing premium beef. So that will be the natural choice for us.
I'm interested, when it comes to crossbreeding Wagyu, is there a point where crossbred Wagyu can't be called Wagyu? Does the beef have to maintain a certain percentage of Wagyu genetics to be called Wagyu?
Yeah, and that percentage is 50%. And what we call in the industry F1 Wagyu. So F1 Wagyu is simply a Wagyu sire crossbred with a non-Wagyu dam. And when you do that, the progeny is called Wagyu F1, which represents 50% Wagyu, 50% the other breed. But if you go below that, then you cannot call it Wagyu.
Do you think, in your opinion, is there a significant or noticeable difference between the crossbred and purebred Wagyu?
Yes, there is. There is. When you are breeding purebred, that means a higher Wagyu content. So you get all the flavor attributes that are synonymous to Wagyu, from really the rich flavor, the Wagyu umami taste. You know, the marbling is the currency in Wagyu. So the higher your marbling score, the better the product. So when you are breeding purebred, your chances of getting higher grading, as we call it in the industry, that means higher marbling score, are much higher than when you breed a crossbred. But having said that, there's still big demand for crossbred Wagyu for certain levels of, or certain segments of the market, for certain countries as well. And when we started as a purebred Wagyu producer and breeder, but we saw the demand for a crossbred category. And not only we saw the demand, our customers required a crossbred category, and that's why we created our F2 program. Mm. So there is a place in the market for both categories, but if purebred will give you the closest feel and taste to the Japanese Wagyu, for sure.
So what's next for Padu?
That was Sales and Marketing Director at Padu Wagyu, Hossam Shabake. He was speaking with Jess Baker. And the Pilbara-based company recently won World's Best Grain-Fed Sirloin at the World Steak Challenge in London. So congratulations to Padu Wagyu for that. It's 28 past 12, almost time for an update from the newsroom. First, though, DPIRD has just released a statement regarding those fires in the Midwest. DPIRD is Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development. The statement says they have activated the state support plan for animal welfare in emergencies, and DPIRD officers will work with response agencies to coordinate necessary animal welfare measures. People who require assistance because they have animals impacted by the fires should contact their local government in the first instance, and they will coordinate with DFES and DPIRD. It is time for the news. Jonathan Hopper is in the studio. What's happening in the news, Jonathan?
Good afternoon, Georgia. A local farmer helping to battle bushfires in southern WA has died after a tree fell on his vehicle, crushing the cab. The 34-year-old had been fighting a blaze in Mindarabin in the Shire of Noangarup. The incident happened shortly after 8 o'clock last night on the old Ongarup Road. It's the second fire death in WA's Great Southern this month. New South Wales Parliament will return on the 22nd to 23rd of December to discuss amendments to gun and protest laws. Premier Chris Minns says a bill is currently being drafted to change gun laws, including capping the number of firearms an individual can have, reducing the capacity of shotgun magazines, and removing the appeal process for gun applications. Perth Scorchers coach Adam Voges says he's thrilled for West Australian all-rounder Cameron Green, who's made history as the most expensive overseas cricketer in the Indian Premier League history. The Kolkata Knight Riders bought the all-rounder for just over $4 million. Thanks, Georgia.
Thank you, Jonathan. It is 28 to 1. You're tuning into the Country Hour this afternoon, and it is time for an update from the Bureau of Meteorology. Luke Huntington is here today. Luke, how are things looking in southern WA?
Yeah, hi Georgia. So I'm looking at the Southwest Land Division today. It's generally quiet. We do have an area of thunderstorms just in the very far eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division. So we're talking about pretty much just east of Esperance there. That'll be sort of mainly this afternoon, and there'll be little rainfall if thunderstorms did form in that area. But otherwise, the remainder of the Southwest Land Division is pretty clear and a lot cooler than what we've experienced in the last few days. Along the west and south coast, we're back down to the low to mid-20s, and inland, we're only reaching the low 30s through the wheat belt. As we get further into the week, into Thursday, we are looking at just isolated light showers just along the south coast between Walpole and across to Israelite Bay, just in the onshore flow through there. So just a couple of light showers, but nothing too significant. Thunderstorm activity, we don't have any thunderstorms forecast for the Southwest Land Division tomorrow. And then heading into Friday, we do see a return of those thunderstorms due to a trough. So we could see thunderstorms fire up in the afternoon right throughout that central west district, through the wheat belt area into the eastern Great Southern and into the Esperance region. So it's not really great news because there's not too much rainfall with those thunderstorms on a Friday, so there could be a risk of dry lightning with those storms. The temperatures on Friday are gradually increasing, so we're getting into the near 40 degree temperatures through the inland central west around that Mullawalmora area, and in the northern wheat belts we're getting up to around 38 degrees around that Delwillinew area. So that'll be probably the watch day for any lightning ignitions in that area. And then heading into Saturday, the trough moves eastward, so any thunderstorms contracting back to the very far northeastern parts of the wheat belt and into the Esperance region. Again, there's not too much rainfall forecast with those storms, so dry lightning is going to be a risk in that area again. And then Sunday, we'd see a contraction of the thunderstorms out of the Southwest Land Division again. So it's really just on that Friday and Saturday period for those storms.
Yeah, some dangerous conditions by the sounds of it. How about if we look further north of the state? What can we expect?
Yeah, we are seeing the usual showers and thunderstorms over the Kimberley today, and also across most of the Pilbara into the northern interior, but also extending down through the inland Gascoyne, through the Goldfields and the Western Eucla. So in terms of severe storms today, we do have an area covering the Goldfields region, so that would be mainly for this afternoon. There could be some damaging wind gusts in those storms reaching 90 to 100 kilometres per hour. So if we did see those storms pop up, we'd put out a severe thunderstorm warning with that, so just watch out for that for people in the Goldfields. And then heading into Thursday, we do see thunderstorms continuing throughout the Kimberley still, but probably contracting out of the Pilbara. The main area of sort of severe thunderstorms for tomorrow is through the inland Gascoyne region. So we've got a risk of heavy rainfall through that area. So I think the main location covering that area would be Meekatharra. And again, that's for the afternoon period. And then further southeast, Eucla, we've got just a chance of a light shower just in the onshore flow through there. Heading into Friday, that thunderstorm activity that I mentioned through the southwest land division is creeping back through the Gascoyne and through the northern and western goldfields. So again, Meekatharra, Kalgoorlie is at risk of a thunderstorm on Friday. Again, dry lightning right throughout that region is possible, not much rainfall. And then thunderstorms also for the Kimberley and northern interior. Heading into Saturday, it's pretty much thunderstorms is the story for Saturday for the northern and eastern parts. There's not really any districts that's exempt from the thunderstorms, so pretty much thunderstorms right throughout the Pilbara, Kimberley, interior, Gascoyne, Goldfields and the Eucla. And then Sunday we are expecting probably a contraction from the south, only expecting them over the Kimberley, interior, Pilbara, inland Gascoyne and just the northern goldfields for Sunday.
Thank you for the update, Luke. It is 25-1 and Richard Hudson has the rainfall figures for you.
Yeah, and it's a similar story to the last few weeks, I suppose. Most of the rain in the Kimberley, Anna Plains had 63, Charnley River 7 mils, Signet Bay 12, Diggers Rest 27, Doongan, Ellenbrae and Lansdowne all recorded 5 mils, Fitzroy Crossing 9, Gibb River 28, Gogo Station 22, Kununurra 6, Mount Winifred 20, Old Mornington Homestead had 35, Parry Creek Farm 25 and Wyndham 22. And then in the Pilbara, Indy recorded 5, Carrageenie North 9 and then in the Gascoyne, Churi Creek 12 mils. In the interior, Carnegie topped it with 3. And then in the whole of the Southwest Land Division, the most rain recorded was in the central wheat belt, and that was Kellerberrin and Training West, but they only had 4 mils. Georgia, we've certainly had some sad news this harvest season, haven't we? And as you mentioned at the start of the show, another death. Deputy leader for the Nationals, WA, Peter Rundle, is the member for Roe, which is that area, and he says, in a statement, "I'm devastated by the tragic death of a volunteer firefighter at the Mindarabin fireground last night. My heartfelt thoughts with his family, friends, fellow firefighters and all those in the community who are grieving. The loss of a young volunteer who stepped forward to protect others is profoundly heartbreaking, and it's a stark reminder of the very real risks faced by those who serve on the front line to keep our communities safe."
It is very heartbreaking news. And again, our thoughts do go out to the families and the community there as well.
It's a constant reminder just how dangerous it is, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It is 23-1 on the Country Hour this afternoon. Thank you for tuning in on the ABC Listen app. Now, as we inch closer to Christmas Day, we're starting to ask the big important questions like, what wine variety is best paired with your Christmas ham, seafood platter and fruity pavlova? Ursula Kennedy is a lecturer in viticulture and wine production at the University of Southern Queensland, but she's also done some work down in Margaret River in the state's southwest. She says, whatever wine you're reaching for this holiday season, make sure it's a local drop.
There's a huge range of wines available, Australian and also imported. But of course, choosing an Australian-made wine, you're supporting the local industry, absolutely. Even in your own particular region, we've got the big players, the multi, the big corporations. So it's really important to really support your own local wine regions.
We know interest in drinking alcohol, that has been changing over the past few years. Some people are completely stepping away from drinking alcohol, or some are just choosing to drink less and maybe they're opting for the more premium sort of wines. But do you think there's going to be more non-alcoholic varieties on the table this year? And also moving forward, do you think growers will look to produce more non-alcoholic wines?
Again, really interesting topic. The growth in the low and no alcohol wine sector is huge, and there are challenges around that because the alcohol does actually contribute a lot to the aroma, the taste, the mouthfeel of the wine. So people are starting to become much more interested in purchasing for a number of reasons, including health, alcohol consumption with driving and that kind of thing. So definitely it's an area that's really growing, and the quality of those wines is getting better. There's a lot of research going into improving those wines and the quality of those wines. So definitely that is a burgeoning area of the wine industry. And yeah, when it comes to the lower and no alcohol wines, the sparkling types do tend to have perhaps a mouthfeel, more similar to what we're used to in a typical wine because of the increased effect of that carbon dioxide dissolved in it. So yeah, if you're looking at a alcohol or low alcohol-free or low alcohol wine for around that Christmas period, definitely reaching for a sparkling one, you should be able to find a good one there.
So, Ursula, you're studying your PhD, which is focused on the production of quality wine grapes in increasingly hot growing seasons. And a couple of months ago, we had that national climate risk assessment that was released and identified that southern WA is at risk of prolonged periods of drought. What will growers have to change in order to stay viable in this warming, drying climate?
I've been in the industry for quite some time, and over the decades we've seen moves toward dealing with hotter, drier climates. So it's not something new, and growers over the decades have taken on board a lot of strategies to deal with that kind of burgeoning climate change, including things like being more aware of irrigation timing, mulching, quality of irrigation water, use of different rootstocks that might deal with, you know, drier soils. We're also seeing over the last few decades, a great increase in the range of varieties that we actually have that are being planted. So growers are tending to move to varieties that are from regions that have originated in hotter, drier regions. So these would probably, you know, be regions closer to the equator, for instance, the southern parts of Europe. So we're seeing more of these kind of alternate varieties that are imported from grape growing regions internationally, which bear a similarity to what the projections are for what's going to happen in the Australian climate.
Should growers be making those changes now?
Oh, you can't just kind of pull up a vine and plant another one. I guess you could, but there's a lot involve expense, downtime, getting a vine re-established after the expense of replanting, and also varietal awareness and brand. You know, definitely in WA, your biggest wines, most popular varieties there are Cabernet and Chardonnay, amongst, you know, others, Sauvignon Blanc and so on. So if you're renowned for your trophy-winning Cabernet and then you suddenly replant that all over to some varietal that people don't know, it's going to actually be difficult for you to maintain that market share, if that makes sense. So it's kind of looking at that risk of losing that identity that you have for making that particular wine.
Back to the holiday questions now, Ursula. Yeah. To finish on possibly the most important question of all, what varieties of wine are best paired with the classic Aussie lunch, you know, seafood platter, roasted potatoes, ham? What should you be drinking alongside those Aussie Christmas treats?
Great question. Oh, there's so many wines out there. For a lighter food, choose a lighter wine. So if you're having prawns or a salad or something like that, a lighter to medium-bodied white or even a rosé, even a lighter style red like a Pinot or a Grenache or something like that. And then for the richer foods, your hams and turkeys and cooked meats and so on, again, a richer wine, and this could be a full-bodied Chardonnay or it could be, you know, a Cabernet Shiraz, that kind of thing. Like I mentioned before, the sparkling red would go really well with those. Dessert, typically, of course, you're going to have a sweeter wine with it because, you know, you have too much of a juxtaposition of the flavours of sweetness and a dry wine. So, yeah, for a dessert, definitely go for a sweeter wine, a botrytised wine, a dessert wine, even a liqueur, something like that.
University of Southern Queensland viticulture lecturer Ursula Kennedy. She was speaking with Amelia Searson. And as you just heard, no and low alcohol wines are becoming increasingly popular, and large-scale wineries are now investing into the category. The Australian Wine Research Institute has been working with a big wine company based in South Australia, and they've just released an industry-first research report exploring the future of so-called no-low wines. Karen Petty is the Chief Supply and Sustainability Officer at the ASX-listed company. And he says the future is bright for this category of wine, which is why they're focusing on expanding into that market.
We've been well aware of the trends that sit around alcohol for some time now around consumption, moderation particularly, and seeing some of our consumers drinking less but better, but also this sort of push towards abstinence and even transitioning out of wines. All these things together have given us reason to really focus on the no and low category and, you know, develop products that are best in class.
Treasury Wine Estates has been producing no and low alcohol wines since 1993. What changes have you witnessed since you first started out producing this style of wines?
We've been on it for a very long time. So yeah, that's some great numbers there. So yeah, we've been dating right back into the date you mentioned. But yeah, the way we've seen it progress over that time is probably a mix of things. So originally we sort of did it via traditional type technology. And then you would have seen more recently we made a major investment in the Barossa Valley around the Nolo facility that has really step changed the quality of products. And I'd say the more recent advancement is actually how we've meshed in, for want of a better words, the winemaking craft with the technology. So no one thing works on its own, but putting the two together is very powerful. And the results speak for themselves. The products that we're putting out now are vastly improved from where we started way back when. And I think the future remains bright in terms of where we can take the quality of these products.
You mentioned there the investment in the Barossa Valley facility, which is also using a world first patent pending technology. What exactly is the technology aimed at in the winemaking process?
It's all got to do with the aroma of the wine. So, I mean, probably different to some of other beverages that have had alcohol removed, like beer, for example. We have to think very carefully about the kind of the full consumer experience. So that's the way the wine looks, the way the wine smells, and the way the wine tastes. And this particular piece of technology is all around the smell and the aroma capture of the wine process. So we think now with this technology that we've developed in-house, again, we can step change the quality of wine and hopefully delight consumers along the way.
Senior research scientist at the Australian Wine Research Institute, Dr. Wes Pearson, explains some of the challenges producers of low and no alcohol wines face.
The thing about grapes is that they have a lot of sugar, and we've been selecting grapes for hundreds of years, thousands of years even, to grow that are ideally suited to make wine. And by that, meaning create enough sugar so that we can produce the alcohol required to make something a wine. Up to this point, we haven't found anything really that works quite as good as yeast converting the sugar to ethanol as a way to get rid of the sugar. Part of what makes a wine, is that process of fermentation. That's why you can't just take grape juice and package it as no alcohol wine, because it's not wine yet, right? It really hasn't gone through that process. So turning into wine really up to this point has been, you know, it's required as a first step in these products. And then we can remove the alcohol once we get to that point. That's where these products start. And depending on how much alcohol you want to remove or the kind of product that you're looking to make at the end, that might dictate which kind of process you might want to employ to remove ethanol. You know, there's traditional distillation, there's vacuum distillation, there's some complex vacuum distillation techniques out there that really, you know, do a really good job of removing all the ethanol from wine. There's some membrane processes that are perhaps better suited to, you know, alcohol adjustments or making mid-strength wines. So there's lots of different options there that can be employed to make a wine, either a mid-strength or low or no alcohol wine.
In regards to varieties that are suited for those no or low alcohol wine products, do they differ from the traditional grape varieties that are currently produced to produce full-strength wine?
We're starting to get a bit of experience in trying out different varieties. I think one of the biggest things that we've found so far is that these products, especially if you're trying to make a, what we call, like, you know, a replication product, right? Or a product that's meant to resemble traditional wine. Varieties that are used for sparkling wines or white wines, they tend to be better suited than the red varieties. We haven't quite got, you know, a red variety, like say Shiraz or Cabernet. We haven't been able to quite do that as well as we have been with Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, or Moscato, Prosecco with Glera, the grape that they use to make those wines. Those seem to be better suited to these products. Certainly to this point, that's what we've had the most success with, is with those varieties. And that's probably because, generally speaking, those products are lower in alcohol to begin with. You're removing less from it. And so those wines tend to be, you know, a bit higher in acidity, they're crisper, they're lighter. And so when you take all the alcohol out, that product still does resemble that kind of traditional product a bit more. And so that's where we see where I would say those kind of varieties are typically well suited to this process compared to some of the other varieties the red varieties that we might know. We're also looking at how we can prepare wines in the vineyard and in the winery before they've been de-alkalized so that they're better suited for the process. For hundreds of years, we've been, you know, working with grapes and trying to optimize them to make the best wines, traditional wines. There's no reason to think that should be exactly the same process for these de-alkalized wines. So we're working with how can we grow grapes differently that are better suited for the de-alkalization process? What can we do in the winery once the grapes have been picked that will better suit this de-alkalization process? And that will all help those final products.
Treasury Wine Estates Chief Supply and Sustainability Officer Karen Petty says their main focus currently lies on producing high quality, no and low alcohol wine, but there could be export opportunities in the future.
We're doing this mainly domestically at the moment for some of these products. We push into the US with one of our Sauv Blanc products, which is going particularly well. We see China paying more and more attention. There's press sort of suggesting that, you know, the younger consumers are looking for lower alcohol alternatives. So we're kind of exploring, but really focusing on getting the product right in our Barossa facility before we sort of push heavier and harder out into different regions. But I think the future is incredibly bright. I think it's a global trend that we're facing into. So if we get this right, it could open all sorts of opportunities for the Australian wine industry.
Treasury Wine Estates Chief Supply and Sustainability Officer Karen Petty. He was ending that report from Jessica Schremer. Earlier this year, that company actually spent $15 million on a facility dedicated to making no and low alcohol wines. That facility is over in the Barossa Valley. I want to know what your thoughts are on low alcohol wine, you know, or no alcohol wine even. Text in 0448 922 604 is the number if you'd like to let me know what your thoughts are. It is 9 minutes to 1 o'clock. You're listening to The Country Hour this afternoon. And a mining services company in WA's Goldfields region has been fined $750,000 over a serious crush injury that happened back in April of 2022. The incident happened at a gold mine about 20 kilometres west of Kalgoorlie. A heavy diesel mechanic was performing maintenance work on a stacker whilst it was still in use. The worker became entangled and, as a result, suffered a serious crush injury. For a number of reasons, the court found the company failed to ensure, so far as was reasonably practicable, the health and safety of the worker. WorkSafe Commissioner Sally North says there are still too many instances where conveyors are not properly isolated, which is essential in ensuring the safety of workers. The Commissioner says this incident is an example of the consequences of such failures. And the freight industry is backing calls from the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission for urgent government policy reform to address skyrocketing port charges imposed by the nation's stevedores. An ACCC report found apparent market failure in the sector as transport operators and cargo owners have no ability to negotiate or influence charges. Tom Jensen represents the Freight and Trade Alliance and is glad the ACCC is taking action because he says exporters, farmers and livestock producers have been paying higher port charges for years while stevedores keep posting record profits. Seem to have lost the audio for that story. You'll have to bear with me for just a moment while I try and find it again.
The WA Country Hour with Georgia Hargreaves on ABC Radio WA.
Alrighty, I think I've solved the problem here. So let's go back to Tom Jensen. So he represents the Freight and Trade Alliance, and he was saying he's glad the ACCC is taking action because he says exporters, farmers and livestock producers have been paying higher port charges for years while stevedores keep posting record profits.
So what they've actually uncovered this year, which they hadn't known previously, is the extent of how much profit they're actually making from these charges. So they always knew the per container rate and so on, but essentially now they've estimated that $3.5 billion in incontestable TACs have been charged over the 6 years at increases of around 15% year on year. So they've now suggested that that's 2.5 times the terminal's total capital investment over that same period, which is what the terminals all say they use that money for, is reinvestment in their own terminals and making sure things get more efficient in future.
So, yeah, so basically super profits that's making us uncompetitive, Australia, as an exporter.
Absolutely, yeah. So these charges obviously hit all the grain traders. They hit the horticultural trade associations and so on. So all those different levels of fresh produce and meats and grains and pulses and that go out of the country, they're getting slugged with this, and it's not helping us sell to overseas markets.
At least 15% increase every year.
Yep, at least 15%. This year it was a little more subdued across most of the terminals at about 5 to 15%. But year on year, if you look at the last period from 2016-2017, which is what the terminal operators have been slugging us quite a bit since then, it went from about $25 per container back in that period, now up to over $200 per container.
Now, they say that they're spending money on infrastructure and that, you know, cost, you know, $1 billion here and there, and also they blame high wages from the... But no wharfie's getting an increase every year of 15%.
No, absolutely not. And the fact that a lot of these terminals are now automated, so it's purely...
Less labour, yeah.
Absolutely. So it's not a labour side of things. It's definitely not. And a lot of them have automated straddle carriers and that, which are relatively new in their life cycle. So as to what they expect to spend a lot of that money on, they are doing a lot of rail improvements and that around the country. There's a lot more focus on freight on rail. But as for the extent of it, like the ACCC have uncovered, the revenue they get from this is more than 2.5 times their actual cost of spend.
So they're lying?
Yeah, I wouldn't say they're lying, but they're not telling the wholesome truth that we all expect they probably should when it's coming from transport operators.
And the exporters and farmers are getting slugged, according to the ACCC.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the problem we've got is that they're charging transport operators who have no say in who they choose and how they pick these containers up. So first port of call would be if the terminals charge these actually back to their commercial customer in the shipping lines. And if that's not a possibility, because at least then that would create competitive tension, shipping lines could then buy for the exporter market and the importer market. But without doing that, the only other way around this is to get the government to mandate some sort of regulation on these charges.
That's what the grain growers are calling for.
Yeah, a lot of industry are calling for that. And the Productivity Commission themselves, they did a review under the Morrison government, and they suggested that was the way to go, a mandatory code. And also, obviously, since then, this ACCC report, as well as many in the previous years, have all called for the same mandatory code to be implemented.
Tom Jensen represents the Freight and Trade Alliance, and he was there speaking with Michael Condon.
The WA Country Hour with Georgia Hargreaves on ABC Radio WA.
It's 3 minutes to 12, and there was about 14,200 sheep sold at Katanning today. Tracy Kilner, can you run us through the details, please?
Prices trended down for most categories for our last sale of the year, with quality and easier demand from processor feeders and restockers leading up to the Christmas break. The lamb yarding was again dominated by lightweights, and unfinished lambs eased $10 a head. Trade weight lambs held firm, while the heavyweights lost $10 as well. Mutton eased $20 for stores, while heavyweights fell $30 to $40 a head. The lambs weighing under 16 kilos carcass weight sold from 115 to 173. Heavier lambs made from 160 to $221. Trade weight lambs made from 190 to 245, while heavyweight sold from $218 up to $320 a head. Ram lambs sold to processors for $160 to $266. The Merino store weather hoggets sold from 40 to 132, while medium and heavyweights made from $170 to $218 a head. The Merino ewe hoggets returned from 50 to 150 for lightweight stores, medium and heavyweights sold to $180 a head. Store mutton sold from $70 for lightweight ewes up to $180. Prime medium weight ewes returned from $140 to $200. And the heavyweight ewes over 30 kilos carcass weight sold from $189 to $220 a head. Mature store wethers made from $70 to $156, and medium and heavyweight sold from $158 to $210 a head. Mature rams sold from $60 to $203 to processors, while restockers paid $210 to $216 for young crossbred rams. This has been Tracy Kuhner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for the update, Tracy. So those figures were down 7,696 on last week. Thanks for tuning in to the Country Hour this afternoon. It's time for the news. It's 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.